You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll speak with one of the coordinators of the Wisconsin Environmental Group that brought people from around the state to New York City this weekend for the world's largest ever climate march.
First, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech is looked back on as a masterpiece, stirring the nation's conscience in no small measure because of King's skill at deploying analogies. Let's take a listen.
But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice.
A bank of justice with great vaults of opportunity, where would we be without analogies? Like fish out of water, as annoying as nails on a chalkboard?
Just how powerful are analogies, and how can they sway or persuade us? And they can, as our next guest suggests, play a major role in innovation.
With us now is John Pollock. He's a former presidential speechwriter for Bill Clinton, and he's the author of the new book, Shortcut, How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, before we dig into the power of an analogy, lay out the basics. What is an analogy? And do it without using any analogies, please.
I'll try. An analogy is a comparison that suggests parallels between two different things, either explicitly or implicitly.
Now, you start your book with a great story about how you used an analogy to good effect to sort of land yourself a job at the White House. Can you tell us that story as an example?
Sure. I had been working as a speechwriter on Capitol Hill for a number of years, had left the Hill and got a call one day from the White House. There was an opening on the president's team, and would I be interested? Now, I had tried to get into the White House a number of times and had been unsuccessful. And, of course, I said, yes, I would be very interested. And I went in the next day for an interview. And I sat on a couch in the West Wing in the office of the chief speechwriter, and it was one of those couches that had seen better days. And if I leaned back too far, I'd sink into the cushions and disappear. If I leaned forward, I might fall off, and I was really on edge. And the chief speechwriter looked at my resume and said, "You know, I can see, you know, you've got the qualifications. I've looked at your writing, but what is this cork boat?" And I had added this line to my resume the night before because I wanted to show that I was doing something, not just sitting around. And indeed I was. I had been working to build this boat out of wine corks. I had been saving corks for 30 years, and the goal was to take it on an epic journey. And I explained this quest to him, and I could see that I was losing the conversation there, and that he probably thought I was some whack job, and they couldn't afford to hire a speechwriter who wasn't, you know, of sound mind. And suddenly, as my future slipped away, this analogy popped into my mind, and I don't know where it came from, but here it is. And I said, "Listen, building a cork boat and writing a good speech are a lot alike, because if you take a jumble of one or a jumble of the other, corks or words, disorganized, they mean nothing. But if you put them into just the right order, they'll take you on the most amazing journey."
And that got you the gig.
Well, it got me out of the hole right there.
And
he got the analogy. I ended up getting the job. And it was fortunate that came to mind. It's interesting, though, in the second interview with the other speechwriters, just to check the chemistry between us, they said, "Well, listen, it's toward the end of the Clinton administration. How do you feel about coming in toward the end?" And I said, "Look, dawn and sunset are the most interesting times of day." So a good analogy is a great way to get an idea across quickly and hopefully with some emotional content.
Well, one point that your book drove home for me was that analogies aren't just in lofty speeches. They're all around us. You mentioned this, that save got you out of a hole. Like we encounter and use these analogies all the time without thinking about them. Why is it important to stop and think about them?
Well, a lot of analogies go past unnoticed. And in a sense, that's as it ought to be, because we stop to think about every single analogy that we encountered. We would stop every 3 seconds because they define our language. They define the way we get across ideas. However, we do need to be critical consumers of analogies because at certain points, if you embrace the wrong one, they can get you into big trouble. And so you have to keep an eye out, so to speak, keep an ear out for moments when analogies really play a defining role in which road you take in terms of action.
We hear a lot of analogies in the political arena, and you must have heard many, many of them, not only from Bill Clinton, maybe you wrote some for him, but also from world leaders. How do you use an analogy effectively and also, you know, make sure that it's one that holds water?
I would say that the analogies that one puts in a speech, you have more time, obviously, to hopefully examine them and look at why they might not be true. And this is something I urge people to do. When I say be a more critical consumer of analogy, that's especially important as we listen to all the political debates. And the television ads, for example, in Iowa, the Republican candidate made a really engaging, funny television commercial based on analogy that said effectively, I grew up on a hog farm castrating pigs. Send me to Washington. I'll cut pork. And whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, it's really funny. And there are a lot of parallels between a pigsty and all the mud flying around in Washington. And that ad, in fact, helped boost her campaign a great deal. But here's the thing. The analogy is completely misleading because, as fun as it is, because the skills of castration are completely different than the skills of negotiation and compromise in the Senate, because I can guarantee you there's not a single senator who would agree to have one testicle cut off as a compromise.
Well, outside of pigs and politics, what are a couple of examples that you think of really effective analogies that you've run across in politics, in history, that were accurate, that really made the case and held water?
Okay, I'll give you a great one. Let's take the run-up to World War II, when the isolationists in Congress were saying, let's not get involved in that European war, it's not our business. And President Roosevelt said, we've got to get involved. We need to support the Allies and especially Great Britain. And he was pushing for what became Lend-Lease to supply war material to Great Britain to help fight the German onslaught. And he was at a press conference, and off the cuff he said, look, if your neighbor's house were on fire and you had a garden hose, you wouldn't go to him and say, hey, listen, I need $15 for my garden hose. You'd lend him the hose. They'd hook it to the hydrant, put out the fire, and then you deal with any damage or use to the hose afterward. And this became known as the garden hose analogy. And he said, we need to help Great Britain now. And that analogy really turned the tide of public opinion. And the Lend-Lease program came to pass some months later, and then, of course, a year or so later, we were involved in the war directly ourselves.
We're talking about analogies with John Pollock. He's the author of the book Shortcut, and you can join the conversation. Do you have a favorite analogy that you've used or read or heard? Is there something you've seen as especially effective or misleading in the worlds of politics, advertising, or maybe business?
Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the power of analogies, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite analogy to share, and how do you think analogies spark innovation? Call us at 800-642-1234 or send us a tweet. Our handle is Central Time WPR.
John Pollock is with us. He's a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton, and his new book is Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas.
And in terms of the utility of analogies, how can they help us at work?
Well, people are bombarded with information all the time these days. And if you can make your point succinctly and in a memorable way, then you're going to become a better communicator. So whether you're trying to sell an idea or win an argument or sell a product, analogies can be a very, very helpful tool.
Can you give us an example of an analogy that maybe inspired innovation or helped crystallize thinking to spark innovation?
Sure. What was really exciting about researching and writing this book was that once you started to look at the great breakthroughs in history in terms of technology and ideas, they almost all had to flowed from an analogy that the inventor or the thinker realized. So let's take an example, the moving assembly line. Henry Ford gets the credit, but it really wasn't his idea. It was the idea of a man who worked for him, a young mechanic named Bill Clann. And Clann came back to Detroit from a trip to Chicago, and he said, effectively, guys, I know how we can build cars better. And at that time, Ford was just one of many startups building cars that took about 12 hours per car to build. And he explained how he had seen this disassembly line in the meatpacking plants where the hogs and the cattle were rolled along on these overhead trolleys hanging from hooks, and butchers each doing a specialized task took off their piece and sent it down to the next one. And he proposed doing this in reverse, assembling cars. And the people he worked with said, "What are you talking about? That makes no sense. Those are pigs. We build cars. What do they have to do with each other?" And he said, "Don't you see? It's exactly the same thing." Now, in retrospect, we see that they are. It's moving assembly, moving disassembly, specialized labor as the product moves past. However, if it were so obvious, then the Swift company, with all its millions in capital, would have done it, or the other auto companies would have done it. Ford himself was somewhat reluctant to try the idea, but they put in the line, and the first day there was an accident and they snapped a guy's femur. Mm. And the boss came down and a man named Cousins and said, "Stop this Rube Goldberg machine. We're not doing this." And Clann just begged him to continue. And they stopped the line. And for an hour, Clann tried to explain why this was going to change the world. And at the end of the hour, the boss looked at him and said, "Break all their legs." And they started up the line. And it changed history. And within a year, the time to manufacture a car was down to 90 minutes.
Ah. We'll go to a caller as we talk about analogies at 800-642-1234. We've got Carol on the line in Madison. Hi there, Carol.
Hello. I don't have an analogy to share, but I wonder if your guest would take a minute to explain the difference between an analogy and a metaphor. I hear a lot of analogies, and I know I hear metaphors, And to be perfectly honest, I'm not always sure which is which. Sometimes I am, and other times I'm not. So I want to just briefly explain that.
All right, Carol, thanks for the call. John?
Sure. Carol asked a good question. It's one that many people ask. And the truth of the matter is that similes and metaphors are just a type of analogy, just as a Granny Smith and a Fuji are types of apple. So for all practical purposes, thinking of them as analogies is perfectly fine because they are analogies. And so unless you're diagramming sentences in eighth grade, I wouldn't worry about it.
Now, I know you've thought a lot about what makes for an effective analogy. So what is the anatomy of an effective analogy?
Well, analogies do five things, basically. And the first thing they do is they use the familiar to explain something that's less familiar. The second thing is they highlight similarities and obscure differences. So, for example, the hog castration ad that we talked about, it highlights kind of the messiness of a barnyard and the messiness of Washington, but it obscures the fact that the skill sets are quite different. The third, an effective analogy will identify a useful abstraction. So, for example, in the moving assembly line and the hog disassembly line, the useful abstraction was specialized labor standing still as the product moved past. It's quite an abstract concept to think of it, but that lies at the heart of that analogy. The fourth thing that an effective analogy does is that it tells a coherent story. And it doesn't have to be a complicated story. It just has to be true as far as it goes, such as when I said, dawn and sunset are the most interesting times of day. It's a simple, coherent story. It might not be a complete story, but it is coherent. And the last thing that an effective analogy does is that it should resonate emotionally. And that's really important because analogies, the good ones, generally tap into our emotions.
Do you have a favorite example of that, an emotion that really got hit for you by an analogy?
That's a really good question. I think that an example that comes to mind, and this is a broader analogy, but we were listening in the lead-in to the show to Martin Luther King Jr. delivering I Have a Dream. And he, like many preachers, was adept at analogy. And his success in marshaling public opinion in a divided country going through a difficult transition flowed largely from creating a big analogy between the struggle for freedom for African Americans in America and the struggle of the Israelites seeking freedom from the Pharaoh. And in casting the American struggle in biblical terms, he was able to bring in the moral values of the Bible, the emotional connection that millions of people felt with those values or associated with those values, and really was able to translate a legal challenge into a moral challenge. And that was very powerful. And every time I listen to that speech, it's very moving.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Kim on the line in Madison. Kim, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kim?
Well, one of the things that I thought of a few years back, I was going through my divorce, and it's just an ugly mess if you know anybody who's been through a divorce. But there's this strange kind of curiosity that you get from friends and almost, you know, strangers sometimes, that everybody wants to know how it's going and what's going on, and they're very curious. And I was thinking, you know, I just started telling people, it's kind of like roadkill. You don't really need to see all the stuff coming out, but you just can't stop looking. And I just, that's how I felt. Like, I just felt like this weird, macabre interest in my personal horror. You know?
Kim, thank you so much for sharing that. And John, whether it's a roadkill analogy or a train wreck or a car crash you can't look away from, we often look at our relationships in terms of horrific, heinous, bad things happening.
Yes, and sometimes we describe relationships as blossoming. Our love blossoms, and there you're bringing in associations with flowers and beauty, and then sometimes relationships wither or go bad. They're so useful, and that's why you see them infusing poetry so much.
Let's see if we can take one more brief call. Nick in Greenfield, briefly, what did you want to bring up, Nick?
Yeah, what I wanted to bring up is the point that an author, somebody who pins prose or article, that author cannot plagiarize their own work any more than a human being can be in two places at once. And the reason that I bring that up is because I keep hearing them accusing this writer for Mary Burke of plagiarism. And I'm saying that's not possible. You don't plagiarize your own work.
All right. Gotcha, Nick. And what about the analogy there, John?
Well, I don't have a specific comment on that because I don't know the specifics of the accusations. But I will say this. Is that it's important to give credit where credit's due, and nothing is very original. And the more that in our time of recycling, that there's a lot of confusion around that. But the clearer that people can be, the better. But I'll tell you this. I quote my own work over and over, so I can't blame someone else for quoting their own work.
John, thank you. It's been eye-opening and food for thought. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
That was John Pollock. He's a former presidential speechwriter for Bill Clinton and the author of Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas.